David, this last season, you played your professional season in Poland. How was your team doing pre-pandemic?
We were having actually a pretty good year, actually. At the time that everything shut down, we had just got kicked out. We just got knocked out of a Champions League quarterfinal. We won the first match. It's like a home and away match. So we won the first one in five in Russia, and then we lost in four at home. So that was literally our last match. And then we were about, like, 2 days after that, we were about to go to the cup final. So we were getting ready to go to the cup finals, and then we were currently in first place in the Bundesliga standing. So, I mean, we were having a pretty good season, all things considered. I mean, even before the whole COVID-19 came down, like, our season was a very strange one, but, like, we had a really good team. We had a lot of guys who could just play volleyball, and it was super fun. I was enjoying it a ton, and it was kind of a bummer when everything started to go down and we started to realize that, you know, we might not be able to finish this.
Now, once it was clear that the coronavirus was ramping up to be a worldwide pandemic, how was your exit and return to the USA like?
Yeah, I mean, that whole process was kind of chaotic, a little bit scary at times, just because, like, it was a novel virus. Like, nobody knew what it was exactly. Nobody knew how to prepare for it. Like I said, like, the previous week, like, I'd been flying to Russia for a Champions League match. You know, we were getting word of it. Some of the other pools in the Champions League had, like, Italian teams, and, like, there was big fights. So, you know, like, I think Eric Sochi's team was supposed to fly to Russia or fly to Italy, and they basically refused because when they came back to Russia, they were going to have to be in quarantine for 2 weeks, and, like, they were about to get ready for playoffs. So, like, we literally cannot do this. And so, I mean, I think we, like, Italy obviously gave us a little heads up, just, like, you know, I have a lot of USA teammates in Italy, so we kind of were able to monitor their situation. We saw how drastic the enforcement and the laws and the changes were, like, unlike anything we'd ever seen before. And so, you know, it just became, like, tighter and tighter and tighter. Like, we were playing matches, like, less than a week before, you know, the league got shut down. We were playing a match in front of a full stadium. And then we were supposed to have a Champions League match in front of, like, 10,000 fans. And then they made, like, an adjustment that said, okay, you can only have 1,000 people there. And then, like, the day before the match, we're like, okay, nobody else but the players and the staff are allowed in the gym. And then the next day, like, we lost that match. The next day we came trying to prepare for the Polish Cup. And they're like, yeah, the team we're playing in the semifinals, like, refuses to fly, like, go to the airport and fly from the north of Poland down to Katowice. And so we're like, okay, so we're not playing for the Polish Cup. And it was like, I can empathize with the owners and the presidents of the club, because it's unlike anything we ever had before. So it's not like they had a plan or a protocol they could follow. But, I mean, it was pretty clear early on that that we were going to have to at least take a break. And if we took 2 weeks off, there was no way we were going to be like, okay, first day back, we're going to play a match. Like, we have to ramp up again. We have to get the player, you know, practicing together. And, like, everything was closed down. Like, we literally couldn't even go to the gym. And so, like, right when we started, like, my family usually comes home a little early before I do anyway. My wife coaches at Vanguard, so she usually tries to come home to kind of catch the tail end of the track and field season at Vanguard. And then we usually try to get my son back. He's 8 years old. Try to get him back for the last couple months of school here. And so we were planning on sending him home, like, earlier anyway. And then once the Polish schools got closed down, we're like, okay, we'll send him home next week. Like, we'll have a little bit of time, kind of pack everybody up and send him home. And then we went to sleep, woke up the next morning, both of our phones had completely blown up. Trump had made the announcement that he was shutting down the border. We're like, okay, you guys, like, we literally booked a flight, and within 18 hours, my family was on a plane and going home. I didn't have that option yet because they hadn't canceled the season. Like, we still didn't really know where we were. It's just, we were just getting all these, like, drastic changes, and it was just so alarming and so disturbing. It's like, for me and my wife, we just made the decision to just get the family and the kids home as quickly and safely as possible, and then, like, I'd be able to navigate the airports and trying to fly home solo, or if I had to stay for a couple months by myself, that was fine. But we just were not comfortable with just having the family there and waiting it out, just because you know, like you're stuck in a country with the language you don't speak. I mean, if you need to go to the hospital, I literally could not talk to the doctors, you know. Every time, you know, the club was great, you know, anytime I had to go prior to that, you know, there's always a physio or somebody else on staff who went with me to translate and make sure I got through everything fine. But, you know, when you're kind of fending for yourself, like you just want to be in a place that's comfortable and that you're familiar with. So we made the decision pretty quickly to get my family home. And then, I just kind of hung on as long as I could. And then, you know, the restrictions kept getting more and more strict. They still hadn't canceled the league. And so finally, like, the club was really good. They were like, so if you need to leave, like, we'll support you in that, but we're not going to actually say you can leave because, like, the season hasn't been canceled yet. So, I mean, if it just finally got to the point, like, literally my wife made it was another restriction, like, a bunch of airlines basically finally finalized that they weren't having their normal schedule anymore. So basically the entire flight list got canceled. And so it was like, you literally had to fly in like the only flight home that was available on the websites. And so I got that flight, I literally flew like a really roundabout way just to get back to the States. And when I got back to the States, I booked another flight to get from the East Coast home. But yeah, I hope I never have to do that again. That was just a very stressful time. And even like, and everybody around you knows it. That's the weird part. I mean, you go to the airport and you just feel it. Like everybody's scared. Everybody's like on edge. You look at the flight board and like every single flight's canceled except for yours. I mean, normally there's like 50 flights going in and out at a single time. And like every single flight on that flight board is canceled except for yours. And like, you don't want to talk to anybody. You don't want to be near anybody. And you know, you're all going to get on the same plane. And you're all thinking like, if one person has this virus, like we could all catch it on this flight. And thankfully, like I got home safely. Like I haven't had any symptoms. I got tested last week. You know, I was negative on antibodies and currently having it. So like, thankfully my family and I are safe, but it was definitely, you know, just having so many unknowns was pretty scary.
Well, you know, you throw on the fact that you have a hearing disability, you're legally deaf, and having to be in another country and going through all that, potentially by yourself, has definitely got to add exponentially to the chaos, I'm sure.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like, I've always been lucky that, I mean, I've been traveling around the world for 15 plus years now, but normally when I travel with the team, so I just kind of follow the guys around. But, you know, I'm reminded every time I have to fly solo, which is very rare, but when I do have to fly solo, then it's like I actually have to listen to announcements and, like, the PA systems are just absolute garble for me. I mean, it's like I cannot understand them for the life of me. And then obviously, if I'm trying to speak with flight attendants or hear the pilot over the overhead, you know, speakers, it's like I'm really flying deaf there. No, I'm not flying blind, but I'm flying deaf for sure. But like I said, you know, like I was sure that, you know, the club was going to take care of me if I had to stay longer. I wasn't super concerned about myself. It was just mostly my family that we were worried about, two young kids. I mean, just more factors that, you know, you have to be careful of. And my wife and I just wanted to get the young kids safe and just have some family around in case we needed them, rather than kind of being stuck on an island all by ourselves in Poland.
Yeah. Well, so since you've been back, how's your adjustment been back in the United States? I mean, it's an abrupt departure from Poland, but you usually come back every year anyways for the national team and then travel for national team, but you're actually just at home now. And it's probably been the longest you've been at home since you've started playing professionally.
By far the longest I've been home. But yeah, I mean, that was another adjustment that, you know, I've kind of been working my way through. You know, like you said, normally I get home and, you know, especially earlier on in my career, like I would get home and then I'd be in the gym the next day, you know, like fighting for a spot on the roster. You know, thankfully, like I've got a little more experience under my belt now, and the coaches are willing to give me a little bit of break for my body. But normally I take a week and that's it, and then I'm get back. And I'm at least, maybe I'm not on the court, but I'm at least in the weight room with Tim and, you know, working with AB, get my body right before the long summer. So this has definitely been an adjustment, just kind of being, you know, physically detached from that team, you know, and all the resources and facilities and just camaraderie that I'm used to. You know, so it's been nice to like have that time with the family and like just actually be here. But it is very jarring, the departure from my normal routine that is. And you know, that's taken a lot of adjustment lot of adjustment for me. And you know, it's getting better every day, and slowly, obviously, you know, we're kind of, you know, reducing the restrictions and slowly hoping to go back to something that's a little more like the normal life we knew before. You know, I don't think we'll ever get there. I don't think we should plan on going back to a completely normalized life, but you know, just being able to, you know, get in a gym, see some other faces, I'm looking forward to that.
Now, being legally deaf, I mentioned earlier, but with all the social distancing that's now required outside of your home, what has it been like for you since you heavily rely upon lip reading? Has it been challenging to communicate with people?
The distancing, not so much, because you can lip read from super far away, but the masks are killing me, man. Oh, man. Like, I literally cannot understand. Like you said, I rely so heavily on lip reading. I don't think people really understand how much, like, a vast majority of my hearing is actually lip reading. And so, like, my wife was trying to get me out of the house yesterday. She's trying to send me to get, you know, pick up some food for the family. And it was like, it was a place I was unfamiliar. Like, if I can go someplace that I'm familiar with, I can figure it out. You know, like, I can fake it, I can get by. But we wanted to try a new restaurant. And I was like, I literally don't know who's going to be behind that counter. I don't know how to order. I don't know. You know, like, if they throw me a single curveball that I'm not ready for, like, I'm going to be completely lost, and there's no way that I'm going to be able to get back in that conversation. And so, you know, obviously the people who know me, like, understand that, are patient, figure it out. But, you know, if I meet someone who doesn't, you know, understand me or doesn't know, like, I literally, like, I'm trying my hardest and it's not gonna work at all. But yeah, the mask has been the hardest thing. And obviously, you know, I prefer face-to-face conversation anyways, and so just having to rely on technology, obviously Zoom and video conference calls have been huge for me. But just like straight up phone calls, like, I normally just avoid, but obviously we have to rely on that now. And I obviously have some technology and some stuff that's obviously made it better, but it's still so far inferior to just having a face-to-face conversation and being able to lip read someone.
Yeah, it definitely is challenging. But, you know, obviously from the background that I come from, like, I'm aware of some of the technology that you're utilizing, like your assistive listening device that you're actually wearing right now. You have a signal coming from the computer to your device and your device to your hearing aids. Yeah. I take it that's something that's not very common in the society right now, and at the different places like the restaurants that you go to, or it's got to be a challenge to communicate, if not through sign language, through lip reading, and then you have that device.
Yeah. I mean, like I think this is just like, obviously, like, this talk technology has been huge. I got it. I got sponsored by Oticon a couple times. When I made the Olympic teams, they kind of gave me a couple of devices just like everyday wearing. And then they also gave me this thing that you would reference. It's called a streamer. And it's basically like a wireless connection from my hearing aid to my streamer, and then my streamer to my computer, my phone, my TV, you know, whatever I want to hook it up to, really. And it's been super helpful because, like, I actually have more control over the input that's coming in. It's not just like I make it louder. I think that's kind of one misconception about, you know, people who are hard of hearing. It's like, just make it louder and it'll make it better. And no, just everything is louder, just the same garbled noise. It's just louder garbled noise, you know. And so for this, it kind of filters and actually is able to give me the input or give me the sound that I need that'll make it more clear. I think, there's a couple of illustrations, like, you know, like when you wear glasses, it's just blurry. You got to make it unblurry. Here's like, some things are blurry, some things are not. And it's not just make everything louder, because then the blurry stuff is just going to overcome the stuff that you already hear clearly. And so, yeah, the technology has helped. I mean, obviously, growing up, before I even got to university, like, I had to try to wear regular headphones if I was listening to, you know, computer headphones, and it's just really uncomfortable. Like, I already have these hard plastic behind my ears. I don't need any more stuff on top of my ears. And even, like, the over-the-ears, like, the big old noise-canceling headphones that everybody has those days, like, those still aren't big enough to actually go around my hearing devices. And so, yeah, I mean, yeah, I've just kind of had to adapt to what I can hear and what I can't. Like, it's one of the reasons, like, I rarely, if ever, go to movie theaters, just because I can't understand it. And I prefer, you know, waiting at home. And so I can't maybe lip read movies, but I can read the subtitles, you know. And normally that's not available at the movies, or even when you're flying on a plane. Like, not all planes have subtitles on their little seatback screens. And so I just kind of bring my own, you know, Netflix or download my own movies or whatever, and then, you know, have the subtitles to go with it. And I know I can actually enjoy the movie.
Well, definitely has, I know just from my experience with you and your history, was it Coach Spraw implemented the David Smith rule back at UC Irvine? And is that rule still in play in the USA gym then?
Yeah,
and life? Always,
wherever I go, David Smith rule reigns. No, I mean, it does, but to a lesser degree. I think back in college, it was kind of like let me go. And now, and I think, you know, obviously there was like kind of a pendulum of like how far we take it, and far as like sometimes I would run in 15 feet off the net to take a ball that I probably couldn't control as well, where I should have just let the libero step in and set the ball or whatnot. So now, especially having played with, you know, a lot of guys on the national team for so long, it's like I understand like who's going to get a ball and who needs, you know, when I got to like let them take it, because they're going to have, you know, they're in a better place, in a better position to take that ball and to control it and to put it where it needs to go. But at the same time, like, I know, like, and everybody else knows, like, I'm not going to hear you if you're calling me off. So if I'm calling you off and I think I have a good spot to take the ball, just let me take it and then we'll go from there, you know. And then I hope that more times than not, it's a good play and it's a settable, it's a hittable ball. But if not, like, cover a guy and go from there, you know.
All right, Dave, let's take a break right there. You're watching or listening to David Smith of the USA Men's National Team. I like to say a UC Irvine alumni for obvious reasons. We'll be back in just a moment.
All right.
Hey, good day, everyone. I'm Rob Asparo, and I'm here today on the Viral Volley Podcast with USA Men's National Team middle blocker, 6'8", from Saugus, California, but currently residing in Newport Beach, and a dear friend of mine, David Smith. Thanks for coming on today, David.
No problem. Thanks for having me, Rob.
It's good to have you back from Poland, and you know, I've been following your career as long as, I want to say 2005, because that's when I saw you at UC Irvine. Even earlier than that, actually 2004, because you're supposed to redshirt that first season, and a middle blocker went down at UCI, and you were called to service immediately. I thought that'd be a good starting point for us to talk, being that that's when we first came across each other.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, I came in fall of 2003, and like I said, I was redshirting. And then, like, the whole fall, you know, winter, I redshirted. And, you know, at that time, I wasn't a walk-on, but, like, I was a late, I signed a late letter of intent, like, July after I graduated high school. And so, like, I was just enjoying my time. We had a pretty big freshman class that year. I think it was John's first full recruiting class. It was his second year at Irvine at that time. So we had a ton of guys, a ton of new guys in the gym. So, like, I was just enjoying it, you know. It was, like, my first year away from home. I was enjoying college, just the life, and, you know, getting the chance to continue to play volleyball. And then, you know, like you said, like, one of the guys went down, got injured. I think it was Elephant Bar tournament. So, like, that last preseason tournament before regular season start, you know, I was in the gym getting ready for a normal practice as a redshirt freshman. John comes walking through the door, looks around, finds me, walks over to me. You're coming with us to NorCal this weekend. I was like, wait, what? So, I mean, literally I had 3 days to let all my professors know I wasn't going to be there. And then we flew up to Stanford and UOP and started my college career right there.
Well, you had a very successful career at UC Irvine. And in 2006, you're in the Final Four that we played at in Happy Valley. And that was the famous lights out. I'm pretty sure as nice as Mark Pavlik is, I'm sure he turned out those lights. I'm almost certain. But you had quite a career, though, at UC Irvine. You garnered All-American honors, and you were part of the team along with Brian Thornton, Brent Asuka, Matt Weber, and Taylor Wilson. Who else am I leaving out? Jason Jablonski. Got that first national championship for UC Irvine. Looking back on those years, what do you remember the most, and what do you cherish the most about your undergraduate years?
I mean, it was just I think the best part about it is I remember going in just having no expectation. You know, I think one of the first team meetings we ever had, like John was like, all right, what's our goal this year? And I think it was Spencer Bemis, he was a senior at that time. He was like, yeah, we're going to win a national championship. And I was like, wait, what, huh? Like, we're trying to do that? And John immediately cut him off. He's like, no, we're going to be better tomorrow than we were today. And I think for me, at least, that set the foundation of, you know, understanding like what my goal for the next 4 years was. And that was just to get better every single day. And I had no aspirations when I came in to win a national championship. Irvine wasn't the program that you went to win national championships at that time. And honestly, I didn't like, I'd seen national championships obviously won on television, but it just wasn't something that I felt like was a reality that I could obtain as a student athlete. You know, that wasn't my ambition. And so, you know, just as we continued to get better, I think that's what made my junior year so much fun. It's just like, it felt like we came out of nowhere. You know, my sophomore year, we were terrible. But our junior year, like, we had that core group of guys that were playing together. And like you mentioned, you know, Brian Thorpe from setting, Jason Jablonski, Matt Weber, myself. And then we had a couple guys who were a year younger, like Aaron Harrell was in the middle too. Brennan Suka came that year. And I think we started to finally figure out, like, what we could do, you know. And we started to, you know, form our identity on offense. And it wasn't ever really like, oh, we can win a national title. It was just like, oh, we won that game. And I think we went on like a 20-game winning streak that year or something like that. Mm-hmm. And it was like, oh, wait, like, we have a chance to go to the Final Four, you know. And that was incredibly special going there. And obviously a crushing blow in the semis when we lost to Penn State, like you mentioned. But I remember, you know, the hardest part about that was just, you know, Paul Spittle. You know, I had to give him a hug in the locker room and he was done. You know, that was his senior year. You know, that was his last match. And it was a terrible way to lose in five sets. But, yeah. But I knew for the rest of us, like, we were going to come back the next year. And I just felt like, you know, that was the first year I didn't have junior nationals in the summer. And it's literally the only thing I wanted to do was just stay in Irvine and, like, lift and get stronger and get better and, you know, take advantage of that last opportunity I had as a senior. And I think we did that. You know, I played my best volleyball up to that point, my senior year. I got All-American for the first time. And, you know, just really special, you know, going into that Final Four knowing, like, you know, what we had almost had that last year and how, you know, we were basically going to refuse to lose. In the semifinals, and then, you know, we got to the finals. It was like, oh wow, like, this is it. And it was another tight match with IPFW, but you know, we pulled through, and, you know, the rest is history.
Well, as I go back to that, the 2006 national championship at Penn State and Happy Valley, but yeah, that semifinal match, for those of you who don't know, it was a five setter. Mm-hmm. It was 14-13. And the lights went out, and UC Irvine was making a run at that team to potentially take, at least tie it. Well, yeah, the lights, because of the venue, had a timer on it. The lights went out, and it went dark in the venue, and we were forced to a 15-minute break. And the first serve out of the break, with everyone still trying to warm up and get back in, was a shank pass out of play, which gave Penn State the point in advance of the national championship match against UCLA. So. But yeah, I don't want to shake salt in the wound or bring back a.
No, I'm already seeing it. I just need to let people. I just remember the ball getting shanked over my head, and I'm like, "Darn it, that was it."
Yep, but I do need.
You wanted to come up with some kind of argument to replay it, but I mean, I think it was Max Holt who actually hit that serve.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's Max Holt, Max Proper, or Matt Proper, a few other guys in there. But yeah, it was a good team that it was a great match, but it was pretty apparent that there was a shift in that fifth set. And I'm sure the Penn State guys would argue to the contrary, but
for sure.
You guys are coming back. And that was your team's, I guess, characteristic that season, was the ability to come back and get knock teams down. Because I remember Sparrow describing your team as the blue collar guys, the hard workers that just grind it out.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, like, when I came in my freshman year, like, you didn't go to Irvine to win national championships. I mean, we just had a group of guys that just, you know, were given the opportunity and they didn't want to waste it. I think we just had a lot of guys that were overlooked. And like people say that to me now, I'm like, well, I would have overlooked myself, you know. Like I wasn't like this hot prospect coming out of high school, you know. I was a guy who was still developing, you know. I hadn't had that much experience. And John took a risk on me, and it paid off in the end. But I think we just had a group of guys that, you know, were super competitive, wanted to work. Like we didn't have, you know, like a Taylor Sanders or Aaron Russell or somebody who just completely jumped out of the gym. But we just had, you know, Brian was a really underrated, really smart setter. Shablonski basically got the BIC going in the U.S. Like I think we were the first team to really run it as frequently and as integral part of our offense as we did. And then Matt Weber came along in the playoffs that year, played great. And you know, we had a good team and a solid bond, and it was a lot of fun.
Yep. Well, one of the things that really stuck out for that year that you got UC Irvine's first national championship is you led the nation in attack percentage. You hit 559 that year. And that was in the 30-point rally score era, too. So I mean, you had more opportunities to make mistakes, more attempts, but you still hit that high clip. That was an amazing offensive performance for you that year.
Yeah, I mean, I've been getting better every single year. I think my sophomore, junior year, our other middle blocker, Aaron Harrell, was actually ahead of me in attacking percentage. And I remember, like, John and I had our preseason conversation that year. And I was like, you know what? I want to be like the most efficient hitter on the team, and I want to be the best blocker. And you know, I was able to kind of to lead the team in both of those categories. But I think just having, you know, Brian, who understood the offense so well, having Jason and Taylor Wilson and Corey. Was it Corey? Who was our other? We had three outside hitters, and they were just running the BIC, you know. And like most teams had never seen the BIC, and so I think a lot of teams were worried about that. And I think that's why it's so effective, because it opens up the middle, or it opens up your BIC. And if you have a setter who knows how to use that as, you know, as part of his offense, and it really opens it up and makes it easier for the middle blockers. And so, you know, I've been playing with Brian for 3 years at that point, you know, 3, 4 years at that point, and you know, we had a really good understanding of each other, and he knew where to find me, and I knew that he was going to find me from anywhere.
Now, after your intercollegiate year, you ended up actually sticking around to finish your degree, and then you went off to play professionally. I believe it was in Germany, and it's weird because I looked on Wikipedia, it doesn't even list your German team on there.
That was a long time ago, man. I don't think they usually don't put ancient history on Wikipedia. But yeah, I stuck around. It took me 5 years to get my degree in civil engineering. So you know, like you said earlier on, like I was planning on redshirting my first year, so like kind of everything lined up, and then I got my redshirt pulled, and so now I had a year on the back end instead of the front, and so I think it actually ended up working out really well, because you know, it gave me more time to for my senior project. You know, I got an internship at that time. An engineering company down in Laguna Beach doing false work for bridges and all over the West Coast. And so I actually really enjoyed that time off. And fortunately for me, that was around the time when the national team was moving from Colorado to Anaheim. So they were just starting to build the foundation of the program out here. And, you know, John was the assistant coach for the national team at that point. So he knew I was around. You know, most of the other guys had gone overseas at that point or were still playing college. I was like, hey, you know, like, every once in a while, the team could use a couple extra bodies in the gym. So if you have a couple hours, you know, a few times a week, you know, just swing by the gym and like, you know, keep your touch on the ball. So I was like, okay, great. Like, you know, I thought about playing professionally, but like, it wasn't like on the top of my list at that point. And so yeah, it was just everything worked out really well for me. So I kind of had a job. I was getting my senior degree. I was getting in the gym with Loy Ball and Clay Stanley and whoever, you know, all those big guys that were. You know, obviously Reed and Donald, and so it was super fun. But then, yeah, right when I finally got my degree, like, you know, my wife and I decided, you know, let's just take a stab at it. And so, you know, the first contract that came through that my agent was able to get for me was in Germany. And honestly, at the point, I was like, I don't know, is this like a good contract, a bad contract? I really hadn't had any conversations with the guys in the gym about like where to play. And he was like, hey, you know, it's probably the best you're going to get right now, because like you're a guy who took a year off. I mean, obviously you're an All-American, but that doesn't count for too much overseas. And so you know, I took a chance at it. I was the only foreigner on the team that year, and it was a great experience. You know, like it was a team that just moved from the second league to the first league in Germany, and you know, it was just a group of guys that were just love playing volleyball. We weren't like a great team, but for me it was a great experience. The club was super small, but they were like a family that took care of us and made sure we had everything we needed. And it was just an amazing experience, especially you know being with my wife for the first time overseas, just kind of getting to know each other and getting to figure out who we are as a couple. And honestly, I had no idea that I would still be doing it 12 years later.
Was that 2008 or 2009?
Because it was 2008.
Because on Wiki, it shows your first team that you were on was a Spanish team. Then you ventured over into France and then obviously into Poland these last three or four.
Spanish team was actually my third team. I mean, technically, if we're being really official here, my first team was a two-week job I did in Northern Ireland.
I didn't even know about that, and I've known you for how long?
Yeah, so after 2007, we won the national championship. I was part of the World University game. And so, like, Brian was on the team, Jonathan Winder, Jason Jablonski, Proper was on the team, Evan Paddock, like, a whole bunch of the guys. Like, basically, it was an all-star team for the collegiate year that year. And a couple of years, like, Andy Hine was on that team. And so we went to Thailand, and Alan Knipe was the coach for that team. And while we were there, he's like, hey, I know you're sticking around for school. I have a buddy, because Alan's from Northern Ireland. He's like, I have a buddy who has a team in the Challenge Cup, and they just want to bring a player over for 2 weeks. All my other guys are either going to Puerto Rico or overseas. And so if you're interested, like, get them your information, go play volleyball for 2 weeks, get a little bit of money, and then come back and finish your school. And I was like, sure, I got nothing else to do. So I had a two-week job in Northern Ireland. And then my first real full season was in Germany with TB Rottenberg. And then the next year I went to Puerto Rico, and that was like a 3-month season. So I was in Puerto Rico from like September to January, so like a half a season. And I got home for a week, and I signed that contract with the Almeria in Spain. And I was there for that second half of the season, and then the full season following that. And then after that, I went to France for 5 years.
Yeah, you have a lot of awards from the teams. It just showed that wherever you ended up, the teams were winning. So, and there was some kind of cup or some kind of medal each year of your international season. So, now I'd have to ask you, though, of the years you've been traveling, which is weird because it's been, what, 12, 13 years now, if you look at it.
Just finished 12th season, yeah.
What has been your most favorite country that you've been in so far?
Ooh. I mean, every one of them was really unique for a different way. I think France is probably the most special just because we were on the same team for 5 years. So my wife and I, after we left Spain, yeah, we went to tour for 5 years. I think that was probably the most successful stay I've had at any club. We won 10 titles in those 5 years I was there. So, and it's a great league. I mean, it's a great league for me to develop. I kind of found myself there. I started to develop my game. I was able to go to the Olympics twice while I was playing for tour. And it was like our second home. I mean, like, my wife spoke French. My son was born between my first and second year there. So we had him in like a French preschool. So I was the only one in my family that didn't speak French for a while. But yeah, my wife had a running club, so she was involved in there. We had friends outside of volleyball, which is hugely important for us, just be able to kind of disconnect from, just the demands of the club every single day. Just be able to have people who really don't care who you are as a volleyball athlete, to just care who you are as a person. Right. And for me, that was huge. For my wife, that was huge. And it was just a great situation. We had a really good relationship with the club, the coaches. And it was just super fun. It was always hard. It was one of the hardest things to do, to leave that club. I mean, they offered me, when I was thinking about leaving, they offered me a 3-year contract to come back. And, just professionally, I kind of made the decision that I wanted to try to play in a better league. And it was a risk because I didn't have anything at that point. It wasn't like, teams were fighting over me. But I knew that if I pushed for it, I could find hopefully an Italian job or a Polish job. And, thankfully that's kind of what happened. I was able to get to Poland following France, and I've been there ever since.
Wow. So let's move over into your USA men's national team. You've been to 2 Olympics representing the USA, medaled in 2016 with a bronze. And I imagine 2021 is in your sights as well. Obviously, it was 2020, but because of COVID, it's been bumped up a year. But what does a team look like, and what are your prospects for the team?
Yeah, I mean, like I said, I mean, that was kind of a decision we had to make following 2016. And it wasn't that hard of a decision for me. I mean, I felt like I was playing great volleyball. I felt like I had good volleyball in front of me still. And so I knew, like, my family dynamic were going to change. My wife and I were planning on having another kid eventually, and thankfully she's here. But I knew it was going to probably be tougher because, obviously, I'm not getting younger. But, yeah, my sights were kind of on 2020, and obviously it's 2021 now. But I think we have a good team, obviously. I think we have a huge returning core from that Rio experience. So we have a ton of experience now. We have a ton of guys who are playing at a really high level. And, I think the rest of the world has grown with us. I think there's a ton of good teams out there right now, obviously, Poland, Russia, Italy, Brazil, France is playing great right now. So it's definitely going to be a really difficult tournament, but I'm really looking forward to it. I think it's going to be a lot of fun. Personally, yeah, I think I'm just in the fight for it, you know. I mean, I've been playing good volleyball since the last few years. I think, you know, I have a lot of experience that some of the younger guys don't have. And I really do think I'm playing at a high level still. And so, you know, my biggest goal for this next year is just kind of maintain that level, keep playing. So, unfortunately, I've had, re-signed with Zaska. So, I'm going back to the same team I just finished my season, or kind of prematurely ended my season with. And, I think we have a really good team. I think it's going to be the best situation for me as far as getting me prepared for next summer. That's kind of my end game right now. I don't really know what's beyond, you know, my life beyond volleyball after that, but that's kind of where I'm charging at right now. And I feel like I'm in a good place. I love what I do. I enjoy playing with these guys, and yeah, hopefully we can do some good things next year.
You know, a couple of weeks ago, I spoke to a teammate, outside hitter Taylor Sander, and he had been recovering from injury this last season. But one of the things I've been finding as a common theme is this time of rest, rehabilitation, and healing is actually going to make you guys come back even stronger. What are your thoughts on that?
Man, I don't think it's going to hurt us, that's for sure. I think the biggest thing that's kind of concerning right now is just that we can't be together, you know? I think that's hard, especially for those of us who've been doing this a long time. It's just so unusual not to be able to, like, be in the gym with each other every single day. But, like I said, we have a really experienced group. We have a tight group of guys who've been around each other and just love each other off the court too. So I think I don't think the team dynamic or team chemistry is, like, completely lost. I think, you know, we're going to have to put some effort into it and build it, rebuild it. And I think we'll be in a good place by the time the games come around next summer. But I think the physical healing that you referenced, I think that's going to be huge, you know, not only for Taylor, but for Tommy. And, you know, we had a couple other middle blockers who had, you know, shoulder and knee surgeries too. And, even older guys like me, you know, just getting a month or two off, not having to jump and pound the floor and just actually let my body recover without, you know, attacking it again the next day. I think that's going to be huge. It just takes, yeah. For me, the hardest part is just mentally adjusting to it because I'm not used to having that downtime, just making sure I take advantage of it and making sure I don't go too far off, you know, recovering just and make sure, like, I'm ready to go this next season. Because I think that could be a hidden danger. So some guys just, like, aren't used to re-managing their body to kind of get back into the season are going to be in for a shock, you know, if they don't take care of themselves.
Well, I forgot one of the most important R's that Taylor had mentioned, but reconnecting with family was the other piece of the R's with rehabilitation, recovery, and rest. But how's it been with this extended time being in one place, reconnecting with family for you?
I've been super fortunate that my family's always come overseas with me. So, like, I've always had them there, and I think we have this really tight unit there. You know, we're kind of alone. You know, obviously we have teammates and we have some friends over there, but we do understand that, you know, we're kind of on our own. And so we have a really strong, connection because of that. I really haven't had been able to spend much time with my parents and stuff. You know, I think with social distancing, we just want to be careful. Obviously, my parents are a little bit older. My dad had some lung issues last year, so we just wanted to be extra cautious with that. But yeah, it definitely, you know, for me, yeah, I mean, for me, it's almost like, yeah, we have a lot of time together. It's just a different amount of time, you know, because I think, you know, as a volleyball athlete, like I'm always at home. Like I'm probably physically at home more than most other guys with jobs, just because I don't have like a 9-to-5 job or whatever. You know, I usually have a couple hours in the morning, a couple hours at night, but during the day, I'm usually at home with my family. And so just being able to actually give them the physical energy too has been a big part for me. Just, you know, I take my daughter for a walk every day before her nap. You know, my son, you know, we get to play, you know, board games, and he's super into superheroes right now. So we're doing make-believe all the time. So it's been fun just being able to kind of really, you know, just understand and engage with them instead of just being like, I'm here, but I'm exhausted, so just let me take a nap right now. But yeah, I rather think that mentally, maybe a little, it requires a different kind of energy and a different kind of output. But yeah, it's an adjustment we're making, and I think we'll come out of this stronger than we went in, for sure.
Now, we're in times where that have been unseen in history with COVID, and more recently some of the racial tensions that have just flared up to the highest levels we've seen in our history. What words of encouragement would you want to leave with our listeners and viewers?
Yeah, that's a good one. I mean, obviously, like you said, it's a lot of tension. It's a lot of, I think the biggest thing that I think a lot of people fear is just the unknown. Like the unknown with COVID, the unknown with how the social distancing goes, in a different way, the unknown of, you know, this racial tension and this inequality that's being brought to light. I guess the biggest encouragement that I've kind of almost been reminding myself is just like, yes, you have to learn. You have to continue to learn. You have to, the only way you can do that, I think, is to truly love one another. And that's not always easy when people are on edge and when people are fearful. But I do think that the best way forward is that we have to love and to actually listen to other people's stories. Because, I mean, you have your perspective, but your perspective, unless you step back and really look at it, it has so many biases, good and bad, but just has so many of your own biases and experiences and just the way that you were brought up and what you've learned, and just that's all interwoven into those kind of quick-fire judgments that we make. And unless we actually take the time to step back and to examine ourselves and to see the situation from someone else's perspective, I think it's just going to be a lot of quick-fire responses, and that's not always the most beneficial. I mean, rarely is the most beneficial. So just love and listen, and then just try to make a change. You know, I think it's not always easy. You know, obviously, I'm a white male, so I've had a lot of, you know, privilege and a lot of, you know, even being a deaf person, you know, like I've been able to overcome a lot of things. And not all those things have to do with, you know, the work that I do. You know, it just has to be, you know, these natural things that I was given at birth. But at the same time, it doesn't excuse me from, you know, not seeking the cause of the oppressed. And not even the oppressed. I mean, obviously the oppressed in the racial tension that we have, but also in the COVID, I think a lot of people are just fearful. And that's causing them to protect themselves or to protect the things that they love. And when you're so fixated on those things, it's really hard to step back and take a bigger picture of things. And I think having that conversation is not easy, not easy for me, but it's something I think is necessary. And I think that's what will get us through. And I think it's what will eventually make us stronger.
Oh, excellent stuff, David. Hey, everyone, this is David Smith of the USA Men's National Team, UC Irvine alum, and a dear friend of mine. Thanks for coming on to the Viral Volley Podcast today. And I look forward to catching you on the court in 2021 and hopefully VNL as well and some other international competitions, because I miss it.
Yeah, me too. Me too. I mean, I hope we can find a way forward. But yeah, thanks for helping me on, Rob. It's always good to see you.